Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
I'm just here to unmask the truth about this cesspool we call a city. You're part of this, too.
How am I part of this?
Oh, you're really not as smart as I thought you were. Bruce Wayne.
It's the Riddler's turn to stir up trouble in Gotham City, Josh. Paul Dano goes mano a mano with Robert Pattinson's Caped Crusader in The Batman, which opens wide this weekend.
We've got a review of The Batman, plus Film Spotting Madness Round 1, and our Buster Keaton Marathon continues with 1923's Our Hospitality. That and more.
Drop the. Just Batman. It's cleaner.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. I hope you're ready for a brain teaser, Josh. What is long and painful and also the best time of the year?
What are you riddling me? I mean, I'm all riddled out after seeing The Batman, I'm afraid.
The answer, of course, is Film Spotting Madness, our 8th annual movie bracket style elimination tournament. 64 films enter, only one survives this year. It's the best of the 1970s. Yes, we've got The Godfathers, we've got Jaws, Star Wars, Taxi Driver, Alien, and more, all competing for Madness Supremacy. Our round one matchups are coming later in the show. Also later in the show, Buster Keaton's 1923 debut feature, Our Hospitality, the second installment in our Buster Keaton marathon.
But first, our long national nightmare of not having a new Batman movie, it's been 5 years since Justice League, is finally over, thanks to The Batman.
The Riddler is asking for you.
The killer left this for the Batman. Why is he writing to you?
You came. I've been trying to reach you.
Riddler's latest. It's all about the Waynes. If we don't stand up, no one will.
You got a lot of cats.
I have a thing about strays.
The bat and the cat. Nice ring.
New friend of yours?
I'm not so sure.
Starting with 1966's Batman the Movie, Adam, we've gotten, by my count, 13 feature films about the character created by Bob Kane alongside Bill Finger in 1939. It sort of depends on how you count the two versions of Justice League. Yes, we've had two versions of Justice League. Of course, the Batman mythology has also given us two of the greatest comic book movies ever, to my mind, Tim Burton's Batman and Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight. So we've had the quantity and the quality. Did we really need more? Well, director Matt Reeves of Cloverfield and the last two Planet of the Apes movies has given us more with The Batman. Reeves also co-wrote the screenplay with Peter Craig. Robert Pattinson wears the cowl this time, while Zoe Kravitz plays Catwoman, and Paul Dano is our villain, the Riddler. I'm going to ask you a variation on a question we seem to be asking a lot these days, Adam. Was there a reason for this? We've wondered if we needed another West Side Story, another Scream. Well, how about another Batman? Whether you liked the movie overall or not, we'll get to that. Did it at least bring something to the Batman legend that struck you as provocative, aesthetically arresting, or just plain new?
You asked me to separate whether I like the movie or not, and I won't say, as critics, all of us are guilty of it, but I think often, as critics, we are inclined to connect quality and newness. It certainly gives us plenty to write and talk about, and here, there's a lot to talk about and to like. You're basically asking the question I wrote down in my notes 5 minutes into the movie. It's the question I always hear as Lorne Michaels in my head because of the Bill Hader story where he talks about, I think, going out to perform his Vincent Price bit on Saturday Night Live for the first time. And right before he heads out, Lorne Michaels turns to him and says, "Why now?" The Batman. Why now? What take on this character and this material justifies another go in 2022? And how is the character and material relevant in 2022? What feels timely or significant culturally? I think this movie affords us the chance to tackle both questions, the one in a lot more detail. But where I want to start is the former. What was new? The Batman was new. Not just the actor donning the cowl in that performance, and not just the suit and the gadgets and the vehicles. Bruce Wayne is barely a character in this movie. He has relatively little screen time. Batman dominates the narrative. And I'm waiting now, Josh, for someone to write it and tell me, well, that's not technically true, or maybe it's more than some movies, but less than other movies. We're going to get a breakdown of every movie Batman makes an appearance in, and they'll tell me the exact ratio of Bruce to Batman screen time, and that it's not dramatically different here. Well, it felt dramatically different to me. I don't know about you. Alfred is a smaller character played here by Andy Serkis. He's a much smaller character here in this story than in any of the ones in recent memory, so there's a lot less interaction between the two of them. Scenes with people like Morgan Freeman's character, Fox, or various business associates and various business dealings, there's almost none of that here. The romantic angle with Zoe Kravitz's Catwoman, he's almost always Batman with her, unlike in a lot of the other films. She doesn't know his real identity at all. And I think that's, for me, the most significant part. This idea of his real identity. These comic book movies love to try to show us the blurred line between good and evil, hero and villain. The bad guy at some point is going to remark about how they're really the same, and it usually comes off as psychological gamesmanship, usually rooted in some bit of truth. That's why it's effective. And there's that whole thing about how, you know, Superman is really Superman, and Clark Kent is his alter ego, and Bruce Wayne is kind of the same, that really he's Batman, and he's performing as the playboy billionaire. Well, in the Batman, that's undeniably so, at least it was to me. Batman is who he really is, and he's pretending to be Bruce. He's performing as Bruce. He literally occasionally puts on the costume of Bruce Wayne, and no, he doesn't look anything at all like Christian Bale does when he does dress up as Bruce Wayne. Think about when we see him for the first time wearing that ill-fitting suit, you know, to a funeral. The tie doesn't really work. The shirt is hanging off of him. He is not perfectly manicured in any way at all. And when the villain here says, "We're not so different," it actually carries weight. Pattinson's Batman is a despondent, disturbed, destructive presence. Compassion and truth and integrity matter to him, but he is otherwise fueled entirely by grief and rage. As we recognize the first time we see him fight criminals, think about that in comparison to the first time we see Bale in Batman Begins, and we could get into that, and we could get into how he really is more of a detective here than a vigilante crime fighter than we've ever seen before. But I want to stop. I want to get your take, and I want to see what you thought was most new about the Batman.
Yeah, there's a lot of detective work in here, which I liked quite a bit, yeah, actually. But he's still that vigilante, absolutely. Maybe that's why they did go with the in the title, is to emphasize exactly what you're saying, that this is going to be a movie about, you know, that figure, that caped figure. If that strikes me as an accurate observation, again, in terms of perception, maybe not screen time, it's because of the moment that caught me short in the final third, I think it is. I believe this is Wayne's third visit to this nightclub that is kind of a central hub for criminal activity. And he goes there this time. We assume he's going to go there as dressed up in his Batman outfit because of what he's setting out to do. And he shows up as Bruce Wayne. And that took me back, I think, because why isn't he in costume? But also to your point, because we haven't seen a ton of Wayne, and I had gotten accustomed to this being a movie about the man in the garb. So that does seem like a distinction to me as well. For me, you know, a lot of this was nevertheless very familiar. The darkness was familiar, though I will say I think this is even darker than The Dark Knight and Nolan's interpretations. There, I have not scoured yet what other people are saying, but I know from the screening we were both at, just walking out with our next picture show colleague, Keith Phipps, Seven came up. This is also very much a serial killer thriller, and it carries all the awfulness and darkness of that. But for me, there was something that is maybe not new, but the element I appreciated the most, and maybe this is what happens when you're getting the umpteenth variation on a story, is you start to look at the more granular or I don't even want to say extraneous, because movie scores are integral to what a movie is all about. But we don't always spend a ton of time talking about them. To me, this movie is worth seeing for Michael Giacchino's original score. Of course, best known for Pixar, but a ton of other soundtracks, a ton of other scores he's composed as well. This one, Adam, for me, I came out just with it banging around in my head. Every time that main motif, the theme that he gives for Batman, is used in the film, and it's used multiple times in different ways. It's sort of this brooding, a pursuing, it's like there's four beats to it. And it's like a boot stop. And it is so of a piece with the envisioning of this character to me. It works beautifully. The whole entire score, I think, is incredible. There's even this element where I'm not sure if it's strings or wind instruments, but it's this high pitch it starts at. Brings to mind like screeching bats, and then sort of slides mournfully down into this sound that's in the register of a moan that again captures the darkness of this movie and the distress that's at play. And I came away just thinking, you know, we've got some great Batman scores. We've got Hans Zimmer for The Dark Knight. We've got Danny Elfman for 1989's Batman, the Burton film. I like both of those. I think they're really instrumental in what those movies are doing. But this one just knocks it out of the park. I mean, if we're ranking Batman scores alone, we could rank Batman, we could rank costumes, we could rank cars. But if we're just doing the scores, Giacchino's is way at the top for me.
Yeah, it's really great and certainly is of a piece with the film and its overall aesthetic. And I love the word you used. It does often feel like a moan. And then at the same time, Mr. Movies Are Prayers, the invocation in that theme of Ave Maria and how it returns again and again.
Yeah, I use that a lot.
There's this sense of yearning, but there's also a certain bleakness to that, even that we don't usually associate, I think, with that song that Giacchino provides a really interesting variation on. And that's kind of the theme here, interesting variations on what we've seen before from Batman. I mentioned the first fight scene. I mean, think about when Bale attacks some bad guys in Batman Begins. I think it's the first time where we really see him attack some guys around a truck or a shipping container, that whole sequence. And, you know, he likes to play with them a little bit. He toys with them. There's a gracefulness to the way he fights them, even though obviously he is in combat with them. And then you see Pattinson show up for the first time here in the suit, and he is approaching a gang of maybe 8 or 10 people who are attacking a defenseless man. And you see the sheer brute force of it and how that's emphasized with the camera and the editing and the sound design as well. And I remember scribbling in my notes, oh, he's angry.
Mm-hmm.
Like
a little bit.
Like, he's mad in a way that I don't remember ever seeing from Bale's Batman, or certainly from Keaton's Batman. I didn't see all of the ones in between, but there really is that rage I mentioned that is driving so much of what he does as the Batman. It's not just in his demeanor and the force and the thrust of his punches and his kicks. There's a moment where he's got a guy on the ground. This is early in the film. There's kind of a callback to it, I think, later mm-hmm. in the movie, but he has a guy on the ground and he just keeps wailing. That's not something we would see from one of the other actors who played Batman, one of these other versions of Batman. And even then, when we get Bruce Wayne here, when we get Pattinson out of the cowl, he's despondent and disturbed. And the fact that they truly make him this almost, you know, Robert Smith from The Cure-like character with the eye makeup and the kind of spiky hair going all emo and angsty, right? The pale skin and the black dress. Again, it's something we did not get previously on screen, and I found it pretty fascinating.
It works really well with this character because it's emo, but it's also goth, you know. It's like this strange, those are, you know, at least from what I remember in high school, those were distinct identities, right? But they've kind of merged both a little bit here in this Bruce Wayne. And the goth part, of course, resonates with the tower he lives in, this gothic tower that is the Wayne Mansion in this film. And I do like the two sides of the character that Pattinson gives us. So we have this morose Bruce Wayne when he's not dressed up as Batman, and he speaks quietly. He's clearly also disturbed, and there's a simmering anger there, but he speaks quietly, has almost this polite voice, which interestingly the voice carries over when he puts on the mask.
Agreed.
This is not a growling Batman. This is a soft spoken. When he's talking to the police detectives, you know, he's kind of using a quieter voice. He's not really trying to disguise his voice very much. So that's one side of the character. But then yes, when he's in action, it is an absolutely furious anger, a terrifying anger, actually. And you do wonder how far he is going to go in some of these scenes. The other thing Pattinson did, and this is something I'm still thinking through. We just saw this last night, so it's not exactly a still processing review, but I haven't wrapped my arms around this element of his performance, what he is doing with his eyes. And I think there's something about looking in general going on in this film. There's the whole motif with the eye contact lenses.
Yeah,
that
he's a watcher more than anything.
He records everything he sees as Batman, right? And watches it later. He gives them to Selina Kyle, Catwoman, to use when she's going undercover. And there's even this nice touch where she keeps them and she uses them later to try to connect with him by looking into them. So the screen takes on the point of view of those contact lenses she has laying on a counter, and she looks into them to try to reach him. But that funeral sequence you mentioned, Adam, think about how he stares at everyone he passes so mm-hmm. closely, so intently, to the point that some of them he's previously encountered as Batman, and they do a double take because he looked at them as intently as Batman, and mm-hmm. they recognize him. They think they do. They don't make the connection, but they're thinking, I've seen this guy before. And then there's that confrontation with Paul Dano's Riddler at the end, and we're going to avoid spoilers, though I do have a spoiler question for you I hope we can get to at the end. But that is the first time Bruce Wayne / Batman averts his gaze, is when Paul Dano starts really trying to identify him psychologically. If you notice, it's the first time he looks away. So anyway, all that is to say, there's something about looking going on in this film that I haven't narrowed down what mm-hmm. I think it means to me yet. But Pattinson's performance is key to that. The intense gaze he has, the way he really, really looks at people, he's got the best Batman eyes. Let's say that. There are arguments about who's got the best jawline, who's got this. I think he's got the best Batman eyes, and he uses them to good effect for what the movie wants to do.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I'm going to say it, at least 24 hours removed, I think he looks the best in the suit as well. I honestly do.
Okay.
Compared to any of the other Batmen.
I mean, he doesn't have bat nipples, though. Are you real? I mean, come on.
I know. Yeah, I know. But your point about the double take, I felt that too. And I think I felt it for some of the same reasons I expressed earlier. That lack of a divide between Bruce Wayne and Batman, the note you made about his voice actually helps support that as well, right? He is the same, whether he's in the costume or out. The only difference is, and again, this is the crossover with the villain, is he gets to be the full version of himself when he puts on the cowl and mask. He actually gets to go to the extreme that he probably wants to, but it's just an extension of who he really is. And I, again, have never felt that with some of those other characters. You feel like Keaton and Bale, for example, are willing to, as much as it may be an act, they're willing to embrace that side of themselves. And I'll use that word playful again, and be a little bit suave and debonair. And there's just no interest in that whatsoever on the part of this character. I don't know about you. I was thinking watching this, you already invoked Seven. That element is certainly there. I can't remember if you mentioned Zodiac or not, but you're watching Paul Dano's take on the Riddler, and not only is he using ciphers and writing in code and leaving messages like the Zodiac Killer, but that outfit and the way he stalks people really makes him feel that way. And this story, as we noted, really is more of a detective story, more of a serial killer procedural than we have seen from some of these other superhero movies. And I'll throw in a couple more references, and I don't necessarily have a larger point here either. I just find it kind of funny and a little bit ironic that in film discourse today, if you love these comic book movies, you of course have to see Martin Scorsese as Public Enemy number one, because he was kind of the guy, the auteur, the artist that started all the vitriol towards these films and criticizing Marvel movies and such, right? And yet, for all the latest batch of superhero movies, he's the touchstone for them, right? I mean, there's no Joker without, for me, the much better King of Comedy. And there's no The Batman without Taxi Driver. The narration here, especially that we get early in the film, and it may only recur one more time, you could replace Pattinson's lines there with lines from Travis Bickle, just completely interchangeably. You wouldn't know the difference. And that vision of New York City that Scorsese gives us in Taxi Driver in the mid-70s. When you talk about darker visions of the Batman, what we mean by that isn't just that it's a little bleak or maybe a little cynical or excessively violent compared to some of the others. And the cinematography itself at times is a little bit blurry and certainly isn't relying on a lot of daylight or a lot of primary colors. But I was struck here how much Reeves, or to the extent that Reeves and his team go here to make this Gotham City feel like such a cesspool. There are no throwaway glances of characters or streets. Even when Batman is just driving his car or he's on his motorcycle and we see a street corner, you better believe that street corner is going to be full of garbage and there's going to be a very grimy man rummaging through it, right?
Yep.
The lights are always going to be flickering somewhere because nothing works properly. At times, it felt almost too much. It felt a little oppressive, but I also appreciate the lengths to which Reeves goes here to add to that texture. Every opportunity in terms of the mise-en-scène is an opportunity to add to that mood.
Yeah, and as a Chicago show, we should mention significant parts of this filmed in Chicago, very obvious if you know the streets. And, you know, in our defense, we're not this decrepit, but there is a wideness, I think, and a and a brawniness to some of Chicago's buildings and streets that make it such a good match for this character. So even though Nolan, you know, visited the city for filming his Batman pictures as well, it doesn't feel like an unnecessary retread to come back to Chicago for this. It actually still works. Mm-hmm. And this Gotham, it could be the same Gotham as the Gotham of Joker, the Joaquin Phoenix film. As a matter of fact, Joaquin Phoenix's Joker could be in this movie. You know, he could be, and I know, like, I'm the only film critic in the United States who liked Joker, but that is essentially, you know, the same driving motivation for the Riddler here. And these movies are of a piece, but also different in their own ways. I'm sure this one will be much better received. But yeah, this is another dank, rain-drenched Gotham City. That's where the Seven comparisons come in as well. You know, 75% of the scenes, it's raining. And speaking to your comment about the camera work, you know, the lens is frequently smeared as if it had been rained on. And at least the edges weren't fully wiped off yet. The cinematographer, Greg Fraser, who also did Dune. So just doing some amazing work recently. I wanted to jump to Zoe Kravitz. We just saw her in Kimmy. Both praised her performance there. I think, obviously, she's not the lead here, isn't given quite as much to do. But I do think this is a pretty rich envisioning of the Catwoman character. I'll say this. There were moments where I was hoping, this is a long movie, we haven't mentioned, everyone has, but it's 3 hours. There were moments where I was thinking, I wish we could get back to Selina Kyle and see what she's doing now. And this happened like two or three times. 30 seconds later, there she was. So I do think the movie, you know, gives her a significant amount of attention and narrative, her own narrative of vengeance that parallels nicely with Bruce Wayne's, and gives them this point of commonality. What really she and Pattinson have together, which is intriguing and could also go in the new category, is a lot of heat. There is a great moment. This is relatively early on where they are both, they both kind of infiltrated a crime scene and they're investigating there. They're not supposed to be there. And a patrol officer comes through to just look around. And so even though they've been combating at this point, they have to both kind of freeze and hide essentially. So he has her in his grasp, kind of held against his chest. And so they both stop fighting, are silent so they're not caught. And there's just this beautiful little touch where their breathing kind of erotically falls into rhythm. And it's a little like kind of grace note that gives the film that element of heat that I don't know a lot of other Batman movies have had. And you get it in other moments with them as well. So I thought particularly with Pattinson, Kravitz was quite good.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think Zoe Kravitz is proving here, not just this year, but with some other performances as well, that she's one of those actresses I can't wait to see really in whatever she does. And I have high expectations for Catwoman. Yeah, I still really like Michelle Pfeiffer going back to Batman Returns.
Oh, yeah, she's the best.
But you also know that during our Nolan Ouv review and when we did our awards, I'm pretty sure the Heath Ledger Memorial supporting performance mantle for me went to Anne Hathaway for Interstellar, but mostly for her turn as Catwoman, Selina Kyle in The Dark Knight Rises. So again, big bar there to hit, but I think Kravitz absolutely does it. And you're right, there's something in that erotic tension between them. I'll go back to this idea of kind of elegance that we get with Nolan's films and Nolan's Batman. And that relationship between Bale and Anne Hathaway, even going back to the glamour of Michael Keaton with Kim Basinger in Batman 89. Here, it's the damagedness that brings these two together. And I feel like that is a new wrinkle to that relationship. Now, you asked me about Kravitz. I do have to ask you about Dano as the Riddler. I had a question, one of my honorable mentions, I think, for our movie preview this year was, will Paul Dano have the charisma he needs to play the Riddler? And that's a question I'm posing, having not read a single thing about this movie, looked at any photos or production stills, and certainly not watched any trailers if they were even available at the time. And I'm going off of the kind of traditional take on the Riddler. And that traditional take on the Riddler, of course, which is this very heightened comic personality. And that's not at all what we get from Dano here. I thought it really worked. I thought he was scary in the ways that character needed to be. And this also goes back to what I said earlier in terms of talking about how this movie is relevant now. Unfortunately, due to spoilers, I don't think we can really get into it. But there's an aspect of his character and the, let's say, support he garners that felt a little bit too 2022 to me. And I even found myself at times thinking about the old Clockwork Orange story, you know, and it being banned because people were imitating it. There was a part of me watching this film that feared, oh my.
Yeah.
People might actually, and here by people I mean people who are very troubled, might actually be mobilized by this, even though, of course, that is the exact opposite intent of this movie. At least I think that's the exact opposite intent of Matt Reeves and company. But that's the way it feels watching it because of Dano and that character.
Well, this brings us to another Fincher film, Fight Club, right? Which was accused of possibly garnering that sort of attention and instigating that sort of action. And that was also leveled against Joker. And I think, you could see people making that accusation here. It's obvious in the text of the film that that's not the intent of the film. I mean, in the climax, that's very clear. You're going to have to choose between Batman or this other entity, essentially. But I'll tell you, Adam, I had the same reaction. Like, this movie scared me. And I think it is more of where we are now, because there are elements of this in The Dark Knight Rises with Bane and the support he garners. You know, I think this has been sort of a story point in other comic book properties. But it's where we're at now when, again, spoilers, we won't go into it. It takes that turn. And you see the influence the Riddler has that I got scared. And this turned into something of a horror film for me. And this is not something I'm holding against it. I'm just saying it was very anxiety inducing. And it goes back to this idea of this film being along the lines of a serial killer thriller. And it's anxiety inducing in that way as well. So, yeah, Dano. Okay, I think you said the heightened comic associations you make with the Riddler, right? Oh, he's heightened, but he's not comic. So I think it does work for me. I mean, Ave Maria, he gets this. This was amusing in the credits for the film. There is a moment where he sings Ave Maria to Bruce Wayne. This is a callback for the third time on the song in the film. And he goes for it. He gives a performance and he even gets a credit there, a music credit. Ave Maria performed by Paul Dano.
Oh, I didn't see that.
So it is a huge, huge performance. But I do think it works because the character is also, and Dano seems to understand this, very small. This is one extremely disturbed individual who is doing this. And I think there are moments where Dano taps into that as well. So there's a little bit of balance there in the performance. And again, where the movie goes, it doesn't rely entirely on him to provide the tension and the anxiety and the scares. And so that helps as well. He's not in this film a ton, actually. And a lot of it is in like camera phone footage where he's leaving a message or something like that while he's masked. So yeah, it's a very heightened performance as you might expect from Paul Dano, but I think it's a good one. I think it does work for the film.
Well, I actually don't usually think of Paul Dano in those terms, and that's why I was afraid of the performance he would be asked to give here. And again, I always mention it, but our gauges for big performances are very different. And there's no doubt that there are moments here, including the one you mentioned, the singing moment, where he is very big. He is singing. He is loud. Everything about his physicality and his voice in that moment is undeniably loud. But I think what I'll take away from the performance is the quieter moments. It's actually the more menacing moments. It's the looks, it's the whispers, it's the kind of deliberateness with which he speaks, and that desire to destroy, his desire to be reckoned with, is something that seems insatiable and in that way terrifying. I think you wanted to get to a spoiler question here, Josh. I hope I have a decent answer for it. We will pause. We'll close the review proper. The Batman is currently playing in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our thoughts, email us feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can find our bat signals on social media. What do you got, Josh?
All right. So I don't know where I'm obviously finally going to land on this thing in terms of, you know, comparing it to the other Batman entries. As I've said, I really, really like a couple we've gotten. So do I put it up that high, or is this just, you know, a decent Batman movie? It does have, we haven't even mentioned poor Jeffrey Wright. I mean, our beloved Jeffrey Wright from the French Dispatch mostly has to show up to spout obvious observations. It's not.
Yeah, but he's still fun. I mean, he's Jeffrey Wright.
Okay, I guess. But really wished he had gotten more to do. But here's my question, which does kind of tie into how much I'm going to appreciate this film. There was a moment where I thought, are they really going to do this? Are they going to pull a No Time to Die in a single film? And are they going to kill off Batman and just be like, this is it? We're making this one movie, because it's trending towards his realization that he's somewhat part of the problem. This mm-hmm. goes to your whole thing about him being the flip side of the Riddler. The Riddler, even what I love about this narrative is the Riddler thinks he's an ally. He's another vigilante, right? Until the very
end. This isn't going how I expected it to go at all.
And he says. We think he knows he's Bruce Wayne the whole time. And then we realize he doesn't.
He probably doesn't.
He doesn't. That's that great confrontation scene. Mm-hmm. And so I think as Batman, Wayne even says at one point to Jeffrey Wright, it might be time for the end. This might be the end. Mm-hmm. And the implication is, you know, he's made many comments about he's been fighting crime for 2 years and hasn't gotten anywhere. And it could mean two things. Like, I'm going to give this whole project up, or, you know, something is going to happen to me. So my question for you is, did you get that sense? Did you ever think like they might actually do that? And if they had, and I'm asking this of someone who I think appreciated the killing of Bond. Oh boy, we didn't give spoiler warnings for Bond for No Time to Die.
It's been out long enough.
Okay, all right. Well, anyways, that decision, you appreciated that more than I did, I think.
I did.
Would that have elevated this movie even more for you? Hard to answer, because, you know, you would have had to experience it. But did you ever think that was going to happen? And if it had, what would you have thought of that?
The first one's a lot easier to answer for the reason you mentioned. It's a hypothetical and you're not sure how you would feel if you really experienced it. But in terms of whether or not I thought that's what was happening, again, this is spoiler talk, so we can get into the ending of this movie. That moment where he's on top of the speaker or whatever, and then he shoots his hook into some other structure and falls into the water.
Yeah.
I really didn't understand what was going on. And a big reason why I didn't understand what was going on was I thought he was taking his own life in that moment, because he had that revelation. And because at least two points in the movie, he had mentioned how unafraid he was to die.
Yeah.
And the fact that they have that come up twice, and I don't think I've ever heard another Bruce Wayne say that, it made me realize that, oh, they're planting the seed for something.
Yeah.
This isn't just, you know, that he's a little bit reckless and dangerous or whatever. It is setting up the fact that maybe that's actually where this is going. So in that moment, I thought that's what was happening. I didn't understand visually that he was falling into the water and then he was going to lead these people to safety. But that's still the rebirth, though. There is still the moment of rebirth as Batman, now as a force for whatever the opposite of vengeance is, for compassion, apparently, right?
That's
obviously what they were really trying to suggest in that scene.
Yeah, that's where the movie ends up. I think it's not very well staged, and it's not clear, and I was confused as well, but I think some sort of transformer had exploded and like wires had gone into the water that were threatening to electrocute people. I think what he was doing there was cutting off the power to the transformer, which meant he would then fall into the water. But I was confused like you as well in the moment. Does that make sense that maybe that's what we were supposed to understand?
I totally think that's what was happening. Okay. But yes.
All right. So the other question then, if they had knocked him off, what would you have made of that?
Yeah, I think I probably would have appreciated that more. I had already come to terms. There was enough time in that moment, that slow motion shot of him falling to the water. I wasn't sure how he was going to die from that, but I had already come to terms in that moment with the fact that I can't believe it. They're going to kill Batman. We're only going to get one of these movies. And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
No kidding.
We don't need another string of these films, even though I really like this
film.
And I'm really curious to see the next movie, but I would have been just fine if we didn't get the coda that we get here. In fact, I probably would have been better than fine. I would have thought that it was appropriate. Now, that said, there's another part of me that says, man, to have this character at this age, this relative youth compared to the other Batmen, I feel, to have him go on this journey that he goes on, to have that epiphany, and then for him to not get to act on it, and for us to not get to see him act on it, to not get to see his trajectory as Batman / Bruce Wayne, that also feels like that would be a miss.
Yeah, I think
so. Talking myself back into it.
No, they should have done it. In this era of the reheats, that would have just been too brilliant. They should have done it.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Again, Batman, it's out in wide release. We would love to hear your thoughts. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
No riddles, just death matches when we come back as we kick off Film Spotting Madness. It's our bracket-style movie elimination tournament. Plus, we move from shorts to features in our Buster Keaton Marathon with 1923's Our Hospitality. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
So a few years ago, I was working for a film producer and I'd gone to LA to visit his storage unit. While I was there, I noticed about 12 boxes
filled with letters. There were so many letters.
They were all postmarked January 1970, all addressed to Michael James Brody Jr.
And I'm talking thousands and thousands and thousands of letters stacked in boxes.
And they were all unopened.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That's from the trailer for the new documentary, Dear Mr. Brody, which arrives on demand this weekend. It's from director Keith Maitland, whose last film was 2016's Tower, one of your favorite films of that year, Adam. And I remember this because it's one of my favorite of your number one choices. Really bold. Tower was your best film of that year, right?
It was. And we'll talk about that a little bit more here in a moment, I think.
Dear Mr. Brody tells the story of Michael Brody Jr., a 21-year-old millionaire who, in 1970, promised to give away his $25 million inheritance in an effort to usher in an era of world peace. Now, as you heard in the trailer, he got some interest in that idea in the form of thousands of letters. Based on the trailer anyway, it looks like what Maitland did was a couple of things. He investigated this guy Brody, but then he also tracked down some of the folks who mailed those letters. And this is where it seems like there might be some overlap with what made Tower so compelling. I have not seen Dear Mr. Brody yet, Adam, so please tell me more.
Yeah, I encourage you to see it. I encourage our listeners to see it. You definitely wouldn't connect the two films at quick glance. Tower is a real-time chronicle of a traumatic event, sniper opening fire on the University of Texas campus in 1966, killing 16 people, wounding dozens of others. And it's this combination of archival footage and rotoscoping animation. And Brody is nowhere near as intense and a little more traditional formally, though still very inventive. But like Tower, it connects the past and present, and it lingers by honoring the extraordinary sacrifices of ordinary people. The sniper, who I'm not mentioning either, is never really shown or mentioned by name in the movie Tower, as I recall. And even looking up some details of the movie today, not mentioned in the promotional materials or when you look at a synopsis of the film. He doesn't own the story. He doesn't deserve that recognition. Obviously, Brody's name is in the title of this film. And of course, Maitland is very interested in exploring and unraveling who this eccentric and charismatic and complicated and troubled, but really well-meaning man is. But he's more interested in the legacy of Brody's cause. And that legacy isn't about Brody's actions. His attempts at world-changing philanthropy actually changing the world for anyone. It's about the people who wrote those letters, who sought his assistance, and those stories behind their struggles. Brody becomes the conduit for those stories to be told. I found it really quite moving, maybe not quite as moving as Tower. That movie is really devastating, but still very effective. And no relation, Richard Brody in The New Yorker, in his blurb, recommended Dear Mr. Brody. And here's a connection back to the last film we talked about, Batman. Brody mentions that the dramatic heart of the film is diligent and empathetic detective work. Maitland and the film's producer, Melissa Robin Glassman, gain access to tens of thousands of letters sent to Brody's Scarsdale home and New York office by people asking for money, and after reading many of them, manage to connect with some of the applicants and their descendants. The reason I read that is that word empathetic. I think that is the key word here with Maitland as a filmmaker, at least through these two films that I've seen. He has one other film that came out in 2009 that I still need to catch up with, but there is never remotely a sense of exploiting people for the sake of art, exploiting their trauma for the sake of art. It's always about exploiting art for the sake of people. I did see this movie, I think just about a year ago, back when Maitland was actually a guest on Trivia Spotting and the movie was about to come out at Tribeca. I'm really glad it's now getting a broader release, that you can see it on demand on a lot of platforms. Also, it is playing theatrically in some cities. So if you have a chance, and especially if you were like me, a fan of Tower, definitely recommend Dear Mr. Brody.
So Tower was not only your best film of the year, Adam, but also a Golden Brick finalist back in 2016. In 2017, the next year, the Golden Brick, which is our overlooked film of the year award, it went to Columbus, which is from director Koganada. Like Maitland, Koganada has returned with a much anticipated follow-up, After Yang. That goes into limited release this weekend. We've been really looking forward to this one. Adam, we're going to have a review next week. I think you've already gotten a peek at it.
I have.
I'm seeing it tomorrow night. So can't wait to dig into this one.
Yeah, it has been at least a year, maybe 2 years that we've been anticipating After Yang. And of course, we were anticipating whatever Koganada would make next after seeing and enjoying Columbus so much. We didn't talk about Colin Farrell at all as the Penguin in Batman.
Didn't.
And I think it's a pretty good performance, actually. And it's one where he is completely unrecognizable. A lot of times when we say that about a performer, they're unrecognizable. We don't really mean it. But if someone hadn't told me that was Colin Farrell, I would have no idea.
Can I back
I'd
you up
no
on that?
No sense. Yeah, go ahead.
I heard that he was in the Batman maybe months ago, forgot
about
it.
He got cut out?
Went into the movie. Didn't even think about it and did not know it was Colin Farrell until the credits.
There you go. Yeah. I think a good performance, but definitely one that would be on the bigger side. Well, it's way on the bigger side when you see him in After Yang. And if you did see Columbus, And we recommend that you do if you haven't caught up with that Golden Brick winner. That's a pretty quiet movie. I think the Ferrell performance we get in After Yang is the most subtle, the most reserved that we have ever seen Ferrell on screen. And that'll be fun to talk about with you next week. Also next week, Film Spotting Madness. We will have round one results and the second round matchups to see what we've got planned for future shows. Go to filmspotting.net/episodes.
Quickly, we want to mention what's going on with our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. They're pairing Steven Soderbergh's new Kimmy with 1998's Run, Lola, Run from director Tom Tykwer. So can't wait to hear what they see bringing those two films side by side. Your Next Picture Show hosts are Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts, and you can find more information at nextpictureshow.net. I want to give a quick thank you to those Film Spotting listeners. We had a good handful who showed up for the latest online gathering of the TC Movie Club. This is something I'm doing with the day job. But yeah, just Sunday earlier this week, we had a great discussion about the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men. Saw a bunch of familiar faces there, including a few Film Spotting listeners. This is a series I've been doing, kind of looking at the Coen films through an Old Testament, New Testament lens, and we're wrapping it up this month. The last film we're going to consider is True Grit, one of my favorites of the Coens, and I've been making video essays for each of these movies. I've done four of them now and just posted the one for True Grit on the Think Christian YouTube channel. So you can find that there. And if you want to join us for the discussion, everyone's welcome. It's going to be March 27, 2 p.m. Central. It is Oscar Sunday. So I know if that's a big movie day for you, maybe you can fit us in just before all the festivities begin. But that's 2 p.m. Central on Oscar Sunday. And just go to thinkchristian.net/movieclub. You can sign up there and we'll shoot you an email with the invite link and other information. But yeah, True Grit we've done, No Country for Old Men, Fargo, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? All four of those among my favorites. I've done video essays for each. And if you haven't joined us yet, here's one more chance.
No Country for Old Men, a strong contender for a film that will get an anniversary Sacred Cow discussion on the show this year. 15 years since No Country for Old Men and that great movie year 2007. True Grit for me is one I badly need to revisit. Liked it, gave it a positive review on the show, as I recall. Have it ranked relatively low on my Coen Brothers list, but also it's the Coen Brothers, and I love so many of their films.
Sure.
But one of those movies that, if I'm remembering the order on all of these films correctly, one of those cases where it's just a slight victim of circumstances. You know, I didn't swoon for The Big Lebowski the way I do now, or most people did at the time, because I was coming off Fargo, which I thought was unequivocally a masterpiece. And Lebowski seemed a little bit like a trifle to me compared to Fargo.
Sure.
Similarly, I think it was maybe A Serious Man going to Burn After Reading. And Burn After Reading was one of those Coen Brothers films I just didn't embrace, and I haven't watched it since. True Grit, not the same scenario as Burn After Reading. Did appreciate it, but I feel like it's one that I maybe didn't have the full experience with that I would if I revisited it, because as we have said about the Coen brothers, in terms of those top five filmmakers whose movies you always appreciate more,
yes,
the second time or the third time or the fourth time or the fifth time, you know, PTA is in that mix, and certainly the Coen brothers are one or two.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a general consensus. You know, Serious Man was so well received by critics in particular, that whatever came after it was probably going to seem a little bit slighter. But to go back to Big Lebowski, Bridges in True Grit is just as good as he's ever been. I mean, and the guy's often good.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
This madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
No, this isn't Sparta. This is Film Spotting. But every March, we get a little Sparta-y around here. It's time for the official start of Film Spotting Madness 2022 Best of the 1970s. It's our eighth annual Madness Tournament. We and our listeners have named the best film of the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s. Somewhere in the distant past, we may have determined the best actor and director. I'm not sure if that actor win is something Michael Fassbender still includes in his CV. I hope he does. Oh, we put a lot of work into that tournament.
I'm sure he does.
Though that was our first of these eight tournaments, and man, would we do things so much differently. I think Sam and I only spent about 37 hours planning that bracket.
Yes.
Not 370. So, and look, you can just disregard it.
It went down in flames. It was a disaster. I mean, really, oh, yeah. You can see the lack of effort in that first attempt.
Uh-huh. In case anyone hasn't noticed, Josh, a little bit more well-adjusted than Sam and myself. An important note, round one of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s is live right now. To vote, go to filmspotting.net/madness. Voting closes every Monday at 11 a.m. Central Time, and then new rounds go live on Tuesday. We do give our family members on Patreon first crack at those polls. So if voting early but not often is important to you, it is one of the many perks available to our family members.
Yeah, I imagine as that early voting comes in, I don't know if Sam has like a Siri or an Alexa or a Google Home, but does he have it set up where he's just like, hey, Google, what's the latest Film Spotting poll result? And just gets it spit at him every 10 minutes. Yeah,
he is obsessed, and I am equally obsessed, though. This week, I have been so preoccupied with other matters that I had to be a man of integrity, and I knew that votes had started coming in. Now, again, it's just round one, but I knew votes were starting to trickle in, and I hadn't finished my prediction bracket yet.
Mm.
I was still wrestling with some of the matchups in the Sweet 16 and the Elite 8 and the Final Four. It's going to get so tough, everyone. You have no idea if you haven't looked yet, and if you have filled out your bracket, you have some idea. But I had kept resisting any peeks at the voting because, of course, I didn't want to be tainted. I'm a man of honor. Yeah. I have not looked, and I still haven't had a chance to look, even though I have submitted my bracket. So I can't wait to dive in and start to see where some of these matchups are heading and see how close some of them are. And also we'll see how wide the gap is on some of them. Some of these are pretty easy for us and for our listeners. So actually, that's a good place to start. With our first round matchups, there are 32 of them, of course, because there are 64 films. This is round one, the biggest round. We will not get into all 32 matchups. We will again just encourage you to go to filmspotting.net/madness to vote. You could also link away there to the bracket where you can see all the films. And the big thing is you can fill out your prediction sheet and get a chance at showing how smart you are and getting a chance to win a Film Spotting prize pack. So what we're going to do, Josh, we're going to go through some matchups that stood out to me in terms of being the toughest to choose, me personally, and then the toughest to predict. You, at this point, as of this taping, have you filled out your bracket yet?
No. And to be clear, I don't have access to results, so there's no, you know, risk of me trying to skew things. I'm going to get that. I haven't even seen the matchups yet. So I'm going to go to filmspotting.net/madness right now and pull these up so that I can actually vote as you go through these, Adam. I'll catch up and go through the others. Wait a minute. Wait. Okay. Okay, I'm ready.
I think every March 1, we're just going to temporarily replace you with another host just through the first week of April, Josh.
Don't tempt me.
All right. Toughest to predict. Here's my top five. And I'm curious if you also agree that these are hard to predict, that you really have no idea how voters are going to go. And then I do want your pick as well. My number five, toughest to predict, Eraserhead, David Lynch versus Richard Donner's Superman the movie.
That is difficult. I know there's a lot of affection and nostalgia for Superman. It's also, I think, maybe a little before the sweet spot of Film Spotting listeners' time. I'm going to think the pretension for Eraserhead among voters will win out. And I say that as a pretentious person who appreciates Superman, but thinks it's nowhere near in the league of Eraserhead.
Okay. I think you're probably right. And I'm probably going to lose this one because I went with nostalgia in this case, assuming on the part of our listeners, and I went with the more popular film. I just wondered if Eraserhead is one of those movies, despite how erudite and how learned our listeners are, and hopefully they listen to our Sacred Cow discussion. Maybe
That's right.
It was a blind spot for both of us a few years ago.
Yeah, I think
Eraserhead.
It
definitely was for me. I hope they listen to it and they've seen Eraserhead, but I also think it's possible there are more people in our audience listening right now who still need to see that David Lynch film. But I could be wrong about that. Maybe that film is one they've caught up with on a bigger scale than that Superman film. I predicted Superman would win. I'm probably going to get it wrong. My number four, toughest to predict, Days of Heaven, Terrence Malick, versus George Romero's Dawn of the Dead. Again, pretension here, and we're using that in a kind way, not a pejorative way. The right answer as a cinephile probably should be Days of Heaven, one of the most beautiful films ever shot, but you can't discount the influence and the pure entertainment factor of Romero's film and that very potent satire. I think Dawn of the Dead's going to win, but I think it's going to be really close.
See, this is where not doing my research is going to bite me because, and I should be able to do this off the top of my head, is this the only Malick film? No.
It is not. We're going to hear about another one here in a second.
Yeah. So I'm going to say perhaps at this point, and I think I'm going to go with them. As much as I do like Days of Heaven, I don't think it's like Malick's masterpiece, as some people do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go with Dawn of the Dead personally. And I also think that people may say I'll vote for the other Malick and give the zombies their due here. But
okay.
I say that again without knowing what the other Malick is up against. So,
okay. Well, you will find out here in just a moment. My number three toughest to predict, two Best Picture winners, different years, obviously, in the 70s. Peter Bogdanovich, The Last Picture Show versus Rocky. I don't know. The crowd pleaser that is Rocky, but the film, as we learned, or at least I learned upon our rewatch not too long ago as part of our 7 from 76 series, still a pretty good film too. Last Picture Show.
Pretty good. Pretty good, huh?
Yeah, I'll say that. But Last Picture Show, it has the esteem, it has the acclaim and cachet as a quote-unquote great American film, but I think a lot of people feel that way about Rocky too, and I do give it the edge here.
You're giving Rocky the prediction edge.
I am giving it the prediction edge.
I really, really hope that even if there are some film spotting listeners who think Rocky is a pretty good movie, which I wouldn't go
for
that
far. For the
record,
I think it's better than pretty good.
Oh, okay,
I think it's
okay.
Just good. I think it's good, Josh.
Okay. The good. Okay.
I'll go all the way to good.
All right. Even if you think that, I would hope you would not think it's better than The Last Picture Show. So I'm going to predict Last Picture Show.
Okay. I just took a gander at how the voting is going. And
oh, look at you.
It's going exactly how I thought it would. And what I mean is, in terms of how close it is, this one is a tough one to
predict. The FOMO was getting to you.
Yeah, it was. Okay, number two. Talk about polar opposites. And this is why these ones are so tough to predict, because they are such different types of films, often art house films versus more popular or genre films. The Deer Hunter, the Michael Cimino Vietnam epic versus, you know, just a little movie that people adore, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Ooh,
I mean, Deer Hunter is a clear choice for me as the better film, but I think it's possible the Holy Grail is going to beat it.
I think so too. I mean, we do get complaints, which I would agree with, that there aren't often enough comedies in these brackets. And so that crowd is going to take the opportunity to vote for something as good as the Holy Grail over something. I mean, what can I say about the Deer Hunter? I've talked about it on the show. Last time I saw it was when I was in kindergarten for inappropriate reasons, and I'm still trying to recover. So I don't really have, a critic's view of that movie. I think Holy Grail will hang on in this round and take it.
Okay, we will see. My number one, toughest to predict. Here it is, more comedy and more Malick. Badlands, which I do think is the better film than Days of Heaven. I prefer it to Days of Heaven versus Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles.
Oh. Oh.
How do you pick between those two films? Just so different.
I should have. I think I should have gone this way with the non-Malick choice. I think this is the one where people will choose Blazing Saddles over Malick's Badlands.
You do.
Yeah, I do. I'm going to. And here's the great thing about my prediction ballot, Adam, is I can, based on our conversation and what you reveal to me in your comments, I can alter how I fill out my prediction ballot. Yeah, I'm gonna have to try to retain some of this. I think this one people will go Blazing Saddles.
Okay, that's what I am predicting at this point as well. In terms of toughest to pick, here are my top five. And I have two honorable mentions that are ones we just talked about. For me personally, choosing between Days of Heaven and Dawn of the Dead is really hard, and choosing between Last Picture Show and Rocky is very hard. But my number five is Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets versus Bertolucci's The Conformist. Are you abstaining from this one?
Yes.
Because you haven't seen The Conformist yet?
I am, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, this is how much I love that Bertolucci film. I'm voting for it against a Martin Scorsese film I also love. But that's how good I think The Conformist is, and how much I hope more people will see that film. It's going to lose, but it's getting my vote. My number four. What a great matchup this is in the first round. Two films about marriage, about dysfunctional relationships, scenes from a marriage. Bergman versus Cassavetes, A Woman Under the Influence.
I mean, we're not going to revisit the whole Woman Under the Influence debate we had. I have questions. People can, you know, look back at that review we did as part of our Cassavetes marathon. I'll just say, for me, not as difficult. I'm going to go with Scenes from a Marriage.
Well, guess what? I'm also going Scenes from a Marriage, because that's how much I love that film, even though I also love A Woman Under the Influence. Number three, a music matchup here. Nashville, one of three Robert Altman films in the tournament, versus another Scorsese film, his documentary about the band, The Last Waltz. Here's one for me where I know Nashville's the right answer. Of course it is. It's a film that any cinephile worth his or her salt will say is probably one of the best 50 films ever made, if not top 25. And The Last Waltz is more of a personal favorite, but I'm thinking about the film spotting Madness Incinerator and the fact that if I vote for Nashville, I'll never get to watch The Last Waltz again. And I don't want to live in that world. And it's getting my vote.
That Incinerator, do we get that, you know, a little maintenance check before film spotting Madness every year? Because we use it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
It's good to go.
Tune up.
It's ready to start burning up all of these classic films. Okay. Just wanted to check. Obviously, prediction-wise, Nashville will take it. But I have to abstain from voting. Have not seen The Last Waltz.
Okay. Number two, toughest one for me to pick. Network versus another Altman, The Long Goodbye.
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, personally, recency bias is going to come into play here. We just did Network. Was it last year?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
7 from 76.
Ooh, was that good? Long Goodbye, also good. But I'm going to go Network.
Okay. We're agreeing again. Network is my choice as well. And I truly do love The Long Goodbye. Number one, the matchup that somehow Sam finagled with the seeding in round one just to give me nightmares. If you go to my Letterboxd, where, you know, this is fairly arbitrary, I could change it every day, but I've kept it the same for a long time. And if you go to my Letterboxd and it shows my favorite four films, well, these two films are among those top four. So how do I choose between Annie Hall and Bob Fosse's All That Jazz? I know this will be another one you have to abstain from, Josh, but yes, I have to pick between those two films in round one, and it destroys me, but I'm not picking against Annie Hall here. Not in round one.
Have seen both.
Okay.
Yes. Distant memories of Annie Hall, but I think overall better memories than All That Jazz, which I did like. I'm not an acolyte by any means, but I'm definitely positive on the film. But I think even with the, you know, Woody Allen factor, I'm gonna have to go with Annie Hall on the face of the film itself. Can I give you one now that I'm actually looking at?
You can, but I have a quick question first. Yeah. What movie am I mixing up with All That Jazz then? Because we just talked recently about a film. We were joking about a movie.
Oh, Cabaret. I haven't seen Cabaret.
Yeah, but that's not it. All That Jazz beating out Cabaret in the play-in to go against Annie Hall here in Film Spotting Madness. But there was a film that's a personal favorite of mine that we were joking about how I don't want you to ever watch it because I couldn't live if you didn't appreciate
That's
it.
Right.
I thought it was All That Jazz.
No, I've seen All That Jazz. I saw it like a couple of years ago. It's escaping me which one it was.
Me too. A listener will probably remember. Hit me with your toughest.
All right. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
Versus Shaft. I mean, in what world, except madness, should those two films...
Too bad, mother, shut your mouth.
Even be thought of together, let alone in this scenario where you have to burn one.
See, that's easy for me, despite the fact that I do really, really like Shaft. I mean, it's Wonka. It's for sure Wonka.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I always joke about when I get crap about star ratings, not to sweat the stars, but this is where it is helpful. If I look on my website really quickly, Shaft was a 3.5. Willy Wonka is a 4 out of 4. I mean, a rare 4 out of 4, Adam. So,
yeah. Are you a man of integrity? Are you going to go by your star ratings and vote for Wonka, Josh?
Yes, I am. Shaft will be burnt.
Sorry, Shaft. Wonka might just advance to round 2. We will see how it plays out. We can't wait to hear which matchups gave you the most angst. We've already started to see some of those comments on social media, and you can also comment within the polls themselves. We will feature some of that feedback next week on the show. So a final reminder, you can vote now in all 32 first round matchups of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s, filmspotting.net/madness. There's also a link right on the main page. You can check out the bracket, enter the bracket prediction contest, no fee, all fun. Prizes for the winner, including just your pride. We also always do have our internal prediction contest. The Film Spotting staff, if you will, myself, Sam, the very invested Josh Larson, Mike Merrigan, the listener who gave us the initial idea for a bracket style tournament 8 years ago, and our new PA, Betty Lavandero, and Andy Hampton, if you're out there listening, we've been trying to get a hold of you. You won the bracket contest last year, and one of your prizes that you were excited about was getting to participate in our special bracket challenge. You still have time to get your bracket in and be part of that fun. Andy, where are you? We hope you're out there. Again, everything you need to know about Film Spotting Madness is at filmspotting.net/madness.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
Time to get back into our Buster Keaton marathon. These marathons are a chance to take a deep dive into an actor, director, genre, or regional cinema. With Keaton, we get an actor, a director, and a genre, silent movie comedy. Last week, it was our first installment, and we talked about 4 of Keaton's short films. This week, it's a feature-length comedy, 1923's Our Hospitality. Before we get into the review, Adam, maybe we should talk a little bit about this hiatus that we're going to be taking with the marathon.
We are going to take a little break after the second film and come back with our third installment in 3 weeks, maybe. I'd have to look at the schedule to get the exact breakdown, but basically here's why. We are reconfiguring the marathon around an event that we've teased a little bit, but we weren't really ready to give any more details about, and now it's not official. It's not 100%. Tickets aren't on sale yet, but we are telling you to save the date, and obviously we are rethinking the schedule for the marathon based on the fact that we are pretty sure this is going to happen. So save the date. If you're in the Chicago area or anywhere near it or just want to come visit, June 5th, Sunday, June 5th would be the time, because we think you're going to be able to come to the Music Box, the great institution that is here in Chicago, that incredible theater where we have done different events, including our watch of Rio Bravo back in the before times, and then back in the way before times, our 500th episode was there. We're going to watch a Buster Keaton film on the big screen. Dana Stevens is going to be in attendance and is going to talk about the film with us afterwards. And then not only that, it's going to culminate our marathon. On stage, we're going to tape our marathon awards, the best of our Buster Keaton marathon. So get our picks and get Dana's picks. Here's the other thing. If you were one of those people who was a VIP guest for our 15th anniversary Rio Bravo event in 2020, we're going to bring that back. You'll have an opportunity to buy a ticket, hang out for an hour or so, just have a drink, talk with people like, I don't know, me, Josh, Sam, Dana, Michael Phillips will probably be there, some other friends of the show. It's going to be a great time, a lot more details to come, and hopefully at some point in the next few months, a ticket link to come so you can purchase and attend. But the Music Box is a big theater. Oh, and I think we're going to have a live score played on the organ.
Oh yeah, you mentioned this.
Yeah, for this Keaton event. So a lot of details to be worked out, but it's going to be special, and that is why we're taking just a little hiatus before getting back to Keaton.
Yeah, forget everything else you said. This is a chance to see a Keaton silent film with a live organ accompaniment, which is, you know, not very often you get that opportunity. And if there was ever reason to pause a marathon, I think this is a good one. Let's get back to our hospitality. The plot offers a riff on the Hatfield and McCoy feud. Keaton plays William McKay, who returns to his Appalachian homestead after being raised in New York City, only to find out that the woman he's fallen in love with is a member of a family, the Canfields, that has been in a deadly feud with his family for generations. Adam, last week we split on our favorite of the four shorts that we started the marathon with. We both like them all, but you preferred 1920s The Scarecrow, which has a series of great setups and gags loosely built around Keaton competing for the attention of a girl. My favorite was Keaton's debut short 1 Week, which also had its share of great gags and set pieces, but worked really well as a metaphor for marriage. Our hospitality offers another jaded account of marriage, specifically an element of marriage that 1 Week didn't touch on, in-laws. So should we start this by talking about your in-laws?
We can. I'd be fine spending an entire segment on Sarah's parents, who are lovely people. They're going to come visit in a couple of weeks, and I always look forward to it, Josh.
No guns involved.
No guns involved. They've never chased me around
Brandished
the house.
A weapon. Okay, good.
Inside or outside. No, it's all very civil. It's good.
Nice.
I think those scenes in our hospitality in particular, where they are chasing Buster with a bunch of weapons and taking aim at him, are probably among the funnier in the film. But what really struck me about this movie is, I won't say the lack of comedy, because obviously it's still a silent comedy and there are a fair number of gags and there are plenty of examples of slapstick in the film. But this movie, Our Hospitality, for me is more about marking, and I know there was 3 ages between these, but seeing the quick evolution and the sophistication of his storytelling and filmmaking from those 4 shorts, that's what you really get with Our Hospitality. It's not a series of scenes. It's not a bunch of extended gags. It's an actual dramatic narrative. And the comedy is paramount in those shorts. It is always about the gags and these kind of confined spaces and confined situations. There's an adventure aspect to them, but nothing like the adventure we get here with this tale, where we see him traveling by train and the scale of some of these set pieces, even just the attention to detail and the authenticity with some of the towns he travels through, and the way this movie is rooted in history in a way that obviously we didn't see with those short movies. But in addition to the scale, we get things like that dramatic emotional prologue where we see two men get killed. There's nothing funny about any of it. Two men killed needlessly, one father dead, an infant son left behind, another father just missing his chance to prevent the loss of his son. And from there, when we get into the story proper, it's that journey back to the estate, back to the home that he left when he was an infant, Willie McKay, the Buster Keaton character, and the bulk of the film, the conflict at the Canfields home. Yes, there are some very funny scenes there, but more than anything, it's driven by Keaton's physicality, right? And his fearlessness, his absolute fearlessness in front of the camera. And I knew it was coming because I've seen it before. I've seen Our Hospitality. I've mentioned this before. I took a silent comedy class on Chaplin and Keaton 2 decades ago. So I did remember this film, or I certainly remembered some of the big set pieces. But Josh, that waterfall kind of swing and rescue of Natalie Talmadge, that surely was one of the best, most thrilling action scenes in cinema history up until 1923. But in 2022, it's still incredibly thrilling. I mean, it's actually breathtaking. I did let out a little gasp watching it. Sophie, my daughter, was watching it with me. And at the same moment, she let out a wow. And it was a genuine wow, like amazement at what we just saw, you know, completely buying the illusion of it. The fact that, of course, that isn't really Buster or Talmadge, you know, hanging over a waterfall, surely about to go to their deaths. But everything about the production design of it and the technique used convinces you that that's what you are really seeing. And as I said, I'd seen it before. So, of course, I knew what was about to come as she's coming down the river and he's going to swing out to save her. But also he does show you that he makes it clear by where the camera's positioned that that's exactly what's going to happen. And yet the drama there isn't, how is he going to save her? It's, is he actually going to be able to do it? Is Willie going to be able to do it? But also, is Buster actually going to be able to pull this off? Is Buster Keaton going to be able to pull this off? And of course he does.
Well, the timing of it is just incredible, right? And of course it probably was Keaton. I mean, I didn't research the particulars of this stunt, but he didn't ever really use a stunt double. So that had to be Keaton hanging from that line. And I think that is what struck me about Our Hospitality, is rightfully so. We think of Keaton as a comedian first, but man, even in those shorts we watched, he's a stuntman almost just as much as he is a comedian. I mean, those gags in those shorts were physically grueling, even if they mostly caused laughs. What we get here is a lot of physically grueling work that causes gasps, as you just attested to. And it's just a good reminder that he had those talents as well. Now, coming off directly off the heels of those four shorts, I was struck as well by the level of melodrama compared to the level of comedy. I think we probably get more straight drama than laughs in this film, and maybe because based on purely that prologue you mentioned, which is intensely dramatic and goes on for quite a while before we even see Buster. So this is really interesting to me in that his stuntman prowess is on display and is incredible. When he's straddling those two separating train cars, right? When he's flailing down the river in earlier scenes. And of course, the waterfall sequence you just mentioned, this is really more of a straight up adventure than it is any sort of comedy we've seen before. And if there was anything that made me, I don't know, we might differ a little bit in the, I think you said sophistication, the sophistication of the early attempt to meld those two elements, to meld melodrama and slapstick comedy, because it's kind of old at this point that someone has to choose between Chaplin or Keaton. Obviously, you don't have to. You can love them both, as I do. But I think Our Hospitality was a little bit instructive of how Chaplin, at least at this point, had a better feel for how to merge those two qualities, those two tones together, because Our Hospitality isn't quite, I didn't find it to be quite as seamless in terms of moving from the straight adventure narrative into the stuff that was really lovely, like the bit about when he gets into that train car at the beginning and he's wearing this top hat, right? And he gets into the train car. The ceiling is low, so there's no room for his top hat. He's sitting next to Natalie Talmadge's character at this point, so he feels a little awkward. And he just does a little bit with his hat, a little bit of physical comedy, ends up in the great grace note of him choosing the shorter pork pie hat that we come to know Buster Keaton as wearing, and that's his solution, which is just a great bit. And it made me think, you know, what would our hospitality have looked like if it had played as straight farce all the way through? And it would have been, you know, perhaps a little bit more of a piece. But then again, we would have missed out on some of the more adventure stuff, which is incredible. So yeah, you shouldn't really have to choose. It's just, for me, more a matter of how we move from one to the other.
Yeah, and I think that's fair to an extent. I was definitely going to say that you're right. If we'd gotten the straight farce, then we would miss out on not only some of these amazing sequences, but I think we would miss out on what makes Buster Buster and what separates him from his contemporaries, including Charlie Chaplin, as you mentioned. And I still see the sophistication in terms of the narrative when you think about the sweep of this entire story and whether or not we maybe get much of a character arc or development with the Keaton character himself, Willie. You do see it in other ways, though, like the moment at the end where the feud is finally put to rest. And it's this great scene where Joe Roberts, who we saw throughout those shorts and who I think I read somewhere died like 3 weeks after this movie came out. So his final performance, and what a great final scene to watch, where he is the patriarch of Virginia, the love interest. He finally puts aside this feud, and we get the callback to the sign about loving thy neighbor like yourself. And it's not just hollow, because we actually remember from that prologue how he felt in that moment and what he was actually going to do, that he really truly wanted to put the feud aside, and that that sign had true meaning to him. And so when he sees it again at the end, we buy that moment. We buy it emotionally that he's going to actually conclude it, because he can tap into that emotion, even if it was decades ago. But when I talk about sophistication too, I really am thinking about the technique. I'm thinking about the craft, and I'm thinking about not just the stunts and the scale of that waterfall moment and the whole river sequence, but leading up to that, the gag on the rocks where he's attached to one of the brothers trying to kill him, and the way they fall down onto the rocks and down onto the water. Think about the intricacy of staging that, and also the fear that would have been part of at least some of it, and the way they fall into the water and how real that truly feels, how dangerous that really feels. But then those train scenes as well are pretty remarkable, Josh, when you think about how stationary the camera is in most of those shorts, in most early silent comedies. And then now here we are in 1923, and he's got a train on a parallel track doing these incredible moving, you know, literal tracking shots.
Yes.
You know, it really is pretty remarkable and impressive to watch.
Yeah. It's just outrageous to think about what was actually achieved in terms of the mechanics of each of these major sequences. And I keep coming back to, you know, the comedy bits that he gets in as well, including the extended sequence where he, Willie McKay, has managed to stay at their house, and he's trying to stay overnight because they have this rule that, well, we can't kill him while he's in our home. That would be rude, right? And so all of the ways that his character manages to extend his stay, they want to bid him goodbye so that they can go outside and kill him, and he goes through all these machinations to stay in. So it is this continual balance of the melodrama and the comedy bits like that. I think for me, I could see a little bit more of Keaton sort of, it goes back to like, who is this Keaton character? You know, like who is this guy that he embodies, that he gives us in almost every one of his appearances? Even in those shorts, we could get a sense, like, we feel like we're watching the same guy, essentially, right? And he's this guy who somehow finds himself in the midst of chaos, doesn't freak out, manages through extreme physical feats to keep his head on and stay alive. And that is sort of different, I feel like, than the guy we occasionally get in our hospitality, which is fine. You want a actor, a performer to be able to change. And the rock scene, the cliff scene you describe, is like Keaton has changed into Indiana Jones. It's that sophisticated, as you said, mm-hmm. and that well staged. And it does seem to me somewhere in this film, there's a little bit of a tension between, okay, he's going to be that guy, but then is he also going to be the guy who's, I guess I kept wondering, is Willie McKay like a straight up simpleton who's just kind of lucking his way, blithely escaping these brothers' clutches via these silly twists of fate? Or is he kind of this daring hero who is slyly evading the Canfield brothers mm-hmm. as they're trying to kill him? And from scene to scene, it's almost like Keaton is trying to figure that out too, which again, doesn't mean that either individual scene, there's a fault to it, but you get a sense of Keaton feeling his way into the feature realm and what that means for his persona mm-hmm. in a narrative that is asking for a different sort of character. So it's kind of, you know, it's just an interesting curiosity transitional piece. I feel like we'll know more as we get further into this marathon from this idea of these short comedic films with a pure Keaton persona to features that have something maybe a little more complicated.
Yeah, I think that you could make a case that we're supposed to see a little bit of a trajectory to his character that isn't just him feeling it out or isn't meant to be inconsistency and is actually him sort of embracing being the hero the more that he is actually in a situation where he maybe really has to fight for the thing he wants, which yeah. in this case yeah. is Virginia, because otherwise he doesn't really want anything. I think it gets back to the conundrum we discussed a little bit when we talked about the shorts and the conundrum of the pale face character, that deadpan expression or lack of expression that he always has. He's never emotional or overly excited. He's an agent of chaos, but often, if you really break it down, he's not instigating the chaos. He's just kind of existing within the chaos and trying to survive. And there's an element of that here as well. But then what you get with a character like that, or a result or a consequence of it, could be that it feels like there's a bit of a lack of agency. And then all of a sudden at the end, there's a ton of agency, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's in control and he's making things happen. And a character who doesn't seem, you know, as I said, to really want anything other than to not get killed, that's not always that compelling, but he does come over the course of this film to want Virginia, right? That's
yeah. Yep.
That's the true. Thing that is motivating him. Our next film in this marathon, or set of films, actually, is going to be 1924 Sherlock Jr. Man, we're getting to some even greater stuff, as I recall it, really quickly in this marathon. And also we'll talk about from a year later, 1925, Seven Chances. Both those films are available on most platforms. As I mentioned, it looks like we're at least 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks away from getting back to the marathon. So you've got a chance to catch up, or you can catch up and jump ahead by watching those next films. Every bit of information you need about our marathons is available at filmspotting.net/marathons. Josh, that's our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, you can find us at Filmspotting, and you can find me at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. The website is also where you can vote in round one of Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 1970s. 64 films have entered, but only one is going to get out. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in wide release this weekend is Matt Reeves' The Batman, starring Robert Pattinson, as reviewed by us earlier in the show. Josh, I felt like you were recommending it. Maybe not as enthusiastically as me. I am pretty enthusiastically recommending it. What say you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you've got to check it out. If for nothing else, the Giacchino score, but there's a lot else to like as well.
Out in limited release and on VOD, Keith Maitland's Dear Mr. Brody, also recommended by me on this show, and on demand is Fresh, a horror movie about the horrors of modern dating. Sebastian Stan and Daisy Edgar Jones star in that. That's on Hulu. Also in select theaters, you can see, and I think coming to Showtime later, you can see the new one from Koganada, After Yang. We are going to devote some time to that film next week on the show and talk about Madness, round two.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
From Chicago. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.